into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. December's Governance and Policy Committee meeting will be rescheduled for January 21st at 6 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Flashpoints. On today's show, we speak with Dan Kovalik about the inauguration of Nicolas Maduro as the president of Venezuela over the objections of the U.S. State Department. Then we'll take a closer look at the marriage between artificial intelligence and government surveillance and the narrowing prospects for privacy in the future. Finally, we end with a conversation with the renowned historian and sociologist Michael Mann, whose work includes the four-volume series, The Sources of Social Power, and books such as Incoherent Empire, The Dark Side of Democracy, and his latest entitled On War. I'm Kevin Pina, and we'll be right back with that and more here on Flashpoints. And you're listening to Flashpoints, and now we're going to turn our attention to events in Venezuela. We know that last week we saw what was ostensibly a small commando team that was captured by the Venezuelan government. They claim that there was an assassination attempt against Maduro. Of course, Maduro was inaugurated today in a public ceremony as the new president of Venezuela, very controversial to the United States, who have refused to recognize his government. Now joining us to talk about that and more is our good friend Dan Kovalik. Dan was the author of the book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. Welcome back to Flashpoints, Dan.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bring us up to date. What's going on in Venezuela?
Well, as you say, there was an inauguration of Nicolas Maduro today, and it seemed to go off largely without any hitches. There were big demonstrations in support of Maduro, and a lot of people came out and even camped around where he was going to be inaugurated, and, you know, it was kind of a festival crowd. There was announced a big opposition demonstration, and there was an opposition demonstration, but it was very, very small. The pictures I saw of it, it just looks small and scattered and puny, you know, so that's interesting. The other interesting thing is he was inaugurated. They moved the inauguration to a place that was away from tall buildings. They were afraid there was going to be some sort of Maidan type attempt where someone might fire from a building and blame the government for that, which, by the way, did happen in 2002. You might recall that was exactly what happened and what led to a coup against Chavez that was short-lived. But essentially, they neutralized any attempt at the opposition to create a violent incident, and his inauguration went off without any problems.
Yeah, we've been looking at the pictures of the crowds there as well. It was they claim more than a million people attended that inauguration ceremony of Nicolas Maduro today in Venezuela's capital. Again, that's the voice of Dan Kovalik. He is author of a book on Venezuela, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela. Well, U.S. foreign policy is certainly not happy with today's events, right? They sort of, whatever happened to Guaido, right? There was this attempt to put Guaido into office. Now he's been replaced by this octogenarian who is now being considered as more legitimate by Blinken and the Department of State?
Yeah, well, Juan Guaido, first of all, you know, he never even ran for president, right? A lot of people think he ran and lost, or that the election was stolen from him. He never even ran for president. I mean, he had no claim to the presidency. That was a joke. But what he did, he provided the U.S. with a conduit to loot billions of dollars from Venezuela, which included stealing Citgo, Venezuela's U.S.-based oil company. And they needed someone that they could, you know, essentially deposit the money to, and that ended up being Guaido. What happened to that money? Who knows? I don't know. But then Guaido showed himself to be completely unpopular and irrelevant in Venezuela. So, yeah, now they've picked this other guy, and I believe he even visited Biden this past week, if I'm not mistaken. And again, you know, the hubris of the U.S. just deciding who they're going to pick to be the president of Venezuela. Can you imagine that? You know, if you think about the fact the U.S. has had contested elections, obviously probably the most contested is the election of 2000, Bush versus Gore. And by the way, it looks like probably Gore won, you know, if all the votes had been counted. But the Supreme Court decided essentially to give the election to Bush, which I think a lot of us were unhappy about. But can you imagine other countries saying, oh, we're going to recognize Gore instead?
Right.
No one did that.
Well, Edmundo Gonzalez is his name, right? Edmundo Gonzalez.
Yes, exactly.
And he's actually, seems like he's a front anyway for Maria Corina Machado, right? Who is really behind the so-called new opposition movement to unseat Maduro, to get rid of Maduro, actually.
Well, that's right. She's been around a long time. She's been an opposition leader for a long time. I've actually met her before. I go to Venezuela quite a bit and have been an observer of a number of elections there and have met her before. And I would say she's a member of what some term the disloyal opposition, meaning she not only opposes Maduro and his United Socialist Party, which is fine. That's everyone's entitled to do that in a democratic system. But she also has called for sanctions against her own country, economic sanctions, which have devastated the country. At times have called for U.S. military intervention to unseat Maduro. You know, so she is herself really a puppet of the United States. And as you say, I do think she's, in the end, the person that the U.S. would want to see in power. She was hoping she was going to be arrested by the Venezuelan police. She was predicting that would happen, and seems like she was pretty depressed. That never happened. She was just ignored. So she is walking the streets of Caracas quite freely.
Well, yeah, it seems like she tried to actually set up an event last week where they would arrest her, or she tried to provoke some incident with the police there, the National Guardsmen, and claimed that they had fired at her. And it turned out not to be true, from what I understand, that, in fact, she had manufactured the event.
Yes, well, again, and this is quite typical. And this is, as I said, in 2002, you did have this manufactured event where people were shot at, but it wasn't by the government. It was by people opposing the government. They tried to frame the government. It led to Chavez being unseated for a time. So this is a classic technique, which, by the way, the U.S. tends to support to overthrow the government. But you have to give the Maduro government a lot of credit. They did not take the bait.
And that's the voice of Dan Kovalik. We're discussing the current events in Venezuela. He's the author of the book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. Well, Dan, it's interesting. It is sort of the classic handbook, isn't it? Of you find disloyal opposition, you cultivate them, you then use NGOs, U.S. NGOs or foreign NGOs, which then support them through back channels. And then suddenly there are these events that are created where they become the victim. And then the government that is in opposition to U.S. foreign policy, or perceived as being in opposition to U.S. foreign policy, then is demonized, right? We've seen that sort of process happen around the world, haven't we?
Yes. Well, you know, you can go all the way back to Mossadegh in Iran, the first leader who was unseated in a CIA-backed coup. The early CIA overthrew him in a coup and did exactly what you said. They supported, even paid people to engage in violent demonstrations, hoping that Mossadegh would react violently, and then they could use that as a pretext to overthrow him. Ultimately, that did happen, and they installed the Shah, who was in power through force and torture until being overthrown in 1979. And there's been many others overthrown in the same way, Arbenz in Guatemala, for example, and the 2014 Maidan coup as well.
Don't forget Haiti in 2004. That was the sort of new, that was the new version of that coup d'etat, right? That was where they really, I saw and documented that, where they really experimented with using NGOs as cutouts to back the opposition.
Yes, and then also in Nicaragua in 2018, Nicaragua's done it, and Georgia, the country of Georgia, has also done it, is passed laws like the U.S. FARA Act of 1938,
right,
which requires foreign agents to register.
And the U.S. has protested it and called and somehow said it was authoritarian.
Undemocratic. Right. How dare you pass a law exactly like ours? Yes, that's exactly correct. But that's, you know, that's what countries are doing to try to defend themselves against these type of operations. And frankly, recently in Georgia, they tried to unseat the democratically elected government through those means, and that did not work. And again, largely because the government was very restrained in the face of violent protests that were being backed by the West.
Well, I guess we can probably expect this to get ratcheted up as it was during the last Trump term, right? Trump really put a full court press against Maduro and against the PSUV in Venezuela. I guess we can expect more of that when he takes office on the 20th.
I would think so. Again, as you say, given Trump's policies the first time, and also given the fact that he has appointed Marco Rubio as a Secretary of State, who's maybe the most hawkish legislator against countries like Venezuela. So, yes, I think you can expect more aggressive measures against Venezuela, increased economic sanctions, maybe even some sort of attempted military intervention. Of course, he's already threatening to militarily intervene in Greenland and Panama. And so we'll see. But, yes, I think, sadly, you can expect more of that.
Well, I didn't mean to chuckle, but Marco Rubio as Secretary of State is a, I find it a bit laughable, only in that it's transparent, you know, given his background and given what seems to me to be very far-right views when it comes to accepting any kind of different approach to governance or to economies in Latin America.
Well, correct. You know, and the Secretary of State, you know, should be, in theory, the head diplomatic officer of the United States, right? But the U.S. has given up on diplomacy, is the truth of it. Blinken has not played that role. He's been a very hawkish Secretary of State. Hillary Clinton was as well. I mean, essentially, the State Department's been converted into the War Department. They tend to be even more hawkish than the Defense Department. And again, picking someone like Marco Rubio only, you know, reaffirms that reality.
Now, of course, Venezuela under Chavez created ALBA, and that was really a proposal to sort of counterbalance the Organization of American States, which, I mean, and let's be honest, has given the appearance over the last few decades of being a handmaiden of U.S. foreign policy, for want of better terms. Explain to people a little bit more about ALBA, and is this having a mitigating factor as Chavez had intended?
I would say no. I think it showed some hope for that. But first of all, it does not, never created kind of a parallel or counter legal system to the OAS, which does have, you know, a whole legal system that's been devised to govern the Americas, and it's been used in very selective ways. The OAS, for example, did support the U.S. coup against Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. It tacitly approved of the Pinochet coup in Chile in 1973. As you say, it really is a tool of the United States. But ALBA never created a system that would be counter to that. And ALBA, frankly, is now a lot weaker than it was when Chavez created it. There are a lot more progressive countries, or I should say progressive governments in power in Latin America at the time he created it, who joined ALBA. That is not the case now. I think ALBA does not have the potential, I think, to challenge the OAS, though I also think the OAS itself is declining in prestige and power, because I think most countries in Latin America, regardless of their politics, don't take it seriously anymore, don't believe it to be a fair broker in relations between the Global South and the United States. In fact, one of the examples of this or symbols of this is the fact that a statue in front of the OAS building is Queen Isabella of Spain, which kind of shows what the OAS is all about.
Well, and you know, it's interesting. There have been so many attempts that you've documented in Venezuela against the Venezuelan government, and it seems that popular support has not waned for the Socialist Party of Venezuela, the PSUV, and Maduro's leadership. But what's your view of that? Do you feel as if it's strengthened in terms of the numbers of people in the streets, the poor barrios, neighborhoods of Caracas and other major cities of Venezuela?
I would say that it's remained strong. I'm not sure it's stronger today than it's been. I think it's probably not as strong as it was under Chavez, who was a very popular leader. But it has maintained itself. Yes, I do think that. And I think it's due to the fact that Maduro has stood up to the United States, that he has engaged in very positive social programs that have helped the vast majority of the country's poor people, including building over 4 million housing units for the people, which has greatly helped folks in Venezuela. He also has this very progressive food program, the CLAP, which he created. So that makes him popular. And then on the other hand, the opposition has shown itself to be completely opposed to the interests of the people. Again, even oftentimes calling for U.S. sanctions that hurt the people. So they have not been able to endear themselves to the electorate of Venezuela.
Well, we're going to keep following those events as they develop closely. Again, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Again, that's the voice of our guest, Dan Kovalik. He is the author of the book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil, has been in Venezuela many times, as well as an observer of elections. Today was the inauguration day of President Nicolas Maduro, over U.S. objections and some of the members of the international community that the United States is so famous for leading in those kinds of charges. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today here on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much.
All right, let's go ahead and take our first break here. When we get back, we're going to speak with Matthew Guarguglia. He's a senior policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We're going to be talking about the new marriage between AI, artificial intelligence, and the digital security state. Stay tuned for that and more here on Flashpoints. And this is Flashpoints. Well, we want to turn our attention now to what has, I think, frightening possibilities for the future. We already live in a surveillance-saturated society. We know from Edward Snowden and from Julian Assange before him that they're spying on us. Everything we do, everything we say, everything we type. But now we have this new advent of the marriage of artificial intelligence and the surveillance state. Joining me to talk about that and more today is Matthew Guargiglia. He is a senior policy analyst working on issues of surveillance and policing at the local, state, and federal level. He's with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Matthew, welcome to Flashpoints.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Well, you know, I when I think about surveillance, I always kind of start with Jeremy Bentham, right? The philosopher in England who built the first prison that was called a private prison called the Panopticon, where the prisoners were in the outer wall and the inner wall were the police, and they never knew whether they were being watched or not, the prisoners. So it automatically altered their behavior. Well, we've been living in a sort of digital panopticon, haven't we?
Yes, in a way. Whatever you watched, whatever you do online is certainly watched by companies, and whether or not the government is watching is one of those things that we like to, being at the center of the panopticon, we can't really tell. We don't really know just what data the government is getting from companies, whether it's being handed over willingly, whether it's done by warrant, whether it's an intercept just, you know, in the great big backbone of the web. So in many ways, it is exactly like the panopticon.
Well, and I was reading, I think it was just last week, I saw that the San Francisco Police Department said that they were collecting nearly 3.5 million photographs a day by their system. There's a photography system that are, I guess, all over the city. Well, certainly a humans could not manage that proportion of imagery. So, of course, that's where AI would come in, right?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing we're seeing AI being used for in the surveillance sense is being able to analyze hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of footage or, you know, millions of individual images and looking for specific things. So that has been, I think, the real kind of revelation is how quickly that can get done now. I mean, surveillance hasn't changed that much. At any point, police could have analyzed all of that data, looked through all that footage. They would have just had to dedicate, you know, thousands of labor hours to doing it, and now AI could do it relatively quickly. Whether or not it's entirely accurate or it misses things or it misidentifies things is another matter, but at least it's much faster now than it was in previous generations.
Well, it also, if there's no humans behind the wheel and the first sort of culling of that information, if you will, is done by machines, what are some of the potential drawbacks of that? I mean, for people's privacy.
Yeah, I mean, false positives and false negatives. And we've seen both have a long history with kind of the slow rollout of AI into surveillance. So where this has a major impact, especially for something like a false positive, you know, is we've seen a few times what they call, you know, like AI weapons detection. So there are these kind of scanners that supposedly using machine learning and AI, you know, understand all the different outlines that weapons could take. And so if a person walks through one of these scanners, they get, and the police will get an alert if somebody has just walked through them carrying a gun or a knife or what have you. So the obvious problem here, the immediate danger and the threat it poses, is that false positives mean that police think they are responding to a person with a weapon, which means that if that's really just a, you know, big pen in your pocket, or, you know, there was a problem identifying certain types of laptops as weapons, then suddenly police are going to be responding to you as if you're armed, and that can have really deadly consequences.
And that's the voice of Matthew Guargiglia. He's with the senior policy analyst with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Well, Matt, what about just the fact that we cannot have any privacy now? It's just, if surveillance is now run by AIs and AIs are so efficient, I mean, we've got cameras on corners, video and still cameras everywhere across our cities in this country. Now there's drones that can be deployed by the police rather easily, by law enforcement rather easily. It seems as if there is less and less room for real privacy. We know that so much of the internet has been politicized, and there's this question of fake news, this question of disinformation. So while we're getting disinformation, we're also being surveilled at the same time. It doesn't seem like a very user-friendly future.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think privacy is totally dead yet. I think we still have the capacity for privacy, but privacy is a team sport. It's something you have to work toward. It's something your community and your network has to work toward. And it's also something we as a society need to think about collectively. You know, I mean, and it starts at the very top. It starts with Congress's complete abdication of passing any consumer privacy bills of note in the, you know, recent future. And so states and municipalities have to take it upon themselves to fight for the types of privacy they want to see. So, you know, for instance, Illinois has passed BIPA, this Biometric Privacy Act, which says that companies can't collect your biometric data without your explicit consent. And so this got Facebook into a lot of trouble because in Illinois they were still using face recognition to identify people and to suggest who you should tag in photos without those people's explicit consent. So there are different types of bills we can pass. You know, over a dozen cities in the United States have banned government use of face recognition so that police can't use face recognition. A number of cities have banned predictive policing so that computers aren't telling police who and where they should be dispatching police because that might be where crime is about to happen. So there are ways of fighting back, and it begins all the way at the top, at Congress, at state level, at city level, and then at community and within your network. You know, using encrypted messaging apps, being careful about what smart devices you let into your home, thinking about if you have a camera on your house, what is it facing? Who is it actually filming and recording every day?
Well, I think that's probably, you know, there is a certain level of control, as you said, but there's also, let's face it, when national security is dropped as an excuse, pretty much all of that goes out the door, right? We've seen it with FISA courts. We've seen it, you know, innumerable instances where in the name of national security, none of that really matters, right?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to, you know, getting the leeway to have some kind of a warrant that allows, quote-unquote, allows mass surveillance, so not just a warrant to, you know, look at one person's Facebook messages or something, but a warrant that allows the government to collect the telecommunications data for millions of people. Yes, at the national security level, absolutely. That's where we see that kind of mass surveillance happening.
And so it's a little scary, though, if you give them the power of AI, and we know that there are so many large corporations that also run private platforms that are involved in cloud development and supplying the cloud to the CIA, to the DIA, to the Pentagon, right? And there's a sort of confluence of interests between them as well. And then you put AI in the mix. I can't help but be a little scared for the future, Matthew. That's my point.
Yeah, no, I totally understand because, you know, it's not like the old days where people were afraid of keyword search, right? Like,
right.
You know, they would have millions and millions of emails and they would search for the word bomb or something like that.
Right.
You know, that's quite different from what we're concerned about now, which is you have AI supposedly looking for, you know, tone. Or you know, there's a lot of companies experimenting with emotion detection.
Right, more subtleties and nuances, right?
Emails, exactly, and also more room for misunderstanding,
right.
More room to interpret, you know, sarcasm or joke or euphemisms or slang as a potential threat, and more chances for you to get swept up in that dragnet.
I really appreciate the work that EFF does, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I know that you guys have been on the cutting edge of trying to fight for the rights of privacy, but more importantly, to try to fight for the rights of consumers of the internet, those of us who, you know, might even have a more public voice. You know, the environment has gotten a little crazy, and I think it's... great work that you guys do. If people want to find out more about your work at EFF, where can they go?
They can go to EFF.org. We're a membership-based organization. And so, you know, becoming a member comes with a lot of perks. It helps support all of our digital civil liberties work. And it gives you access to all of the stuff that we put out and all of the information we produce.
Again, that's the voice of my guest, Matthew Garaglia. He is a senior policy analyst with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We've been discussing the marriage of AI and surveillance in U.S. society and what we can look forward to. Thank you so much for joining us today here on Flashpoints.
Yeah, I'd be happy to come on anytime.
All right, let's go ahead and take another break. And when we get back, we're going to feature my interview today with renowned historian and sociologist Michael Mann, author of several books, including the four-volume series entitled The Sources of Social Power, other books such as Incoherent Empire, The Dark Side of Democracy, and his latest book, On War. Stay tuned for that and more here on Flashpoints. And this is Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, my next guest is a scholar, historian, sociologist, Michael Mann. I don't have adequate words to explain the depth of the four-volume series of books called The Sources of Social Power. Really just a huge sweep of history through the lens of what he calls the IEMP model, which are these networks of social power. I wanted to talk to him today about his views of the contemporary political reality and within the context of U.S. imperialism and empire. Michael Mann, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with, you know, you wrote a book called Incoherent Empire, and it looked at U.S. imperialism, U.S. projection of power throughout the world through your IEMP model. Maybe we'll start there. You want to just explain to our listeners real quickly what the IEMP model is?
Well, the IEMP model, those letters stand for ideological, economic, military, and political. And they are the four sources of social power by which, if you have possession of any of those, you have the ability to get people to do things that they otherwise would not do, that is to exercise power over them. And this is not a kind of single factor system. It is willing to give a kind of equal place to all four sources of social power. What I've done is trace the sources through the historical process and up to today. And when I wrote Incoherent Empire in, I think, 2003, it was just as the Iraq, well, it came out just when the Iraq invasion occurred, the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And I predicted there that though the U.S. would win the military battle, it did not have the political or ideological resources to back that up, and so it could not, let alone not deliver democracy to Iraq, it could not deliver stable government. And in particular, it neglected the fact of the dual religious scene in Iraq, that is, where the country is split between majority Shiite and minority Sunni. And what I said is that in order to rule after the invasion, the U.S. would have to use one group against the other. And that is exactly what happened. In fact, I've never written anything where I made predictions which all came true. But then a lot of people knew that that was a stupid invasion.
That's the voice of Michael Mann, my guest today here on Flashpoints. Very well-known historian and sociologist. Wrote a four-volume set, really. It starts with hunter-gatherers all the way through the Cold War. It's called The Sources of Social Power. He has developed a model called the IEMP model, which talks about social networks of power, the ideological, economic, military, and political networks that form the basis of structure of power in any society. Just a real incredible work. If you get a chance to get a hold of that, listeners, I urge you to. Well, Dr. Mann, I want to talk to you about contemporary empire. The world has changed since Incoherent Empire was written, as you said, in 2003. We now have this sort of almost partisan battle between the Democrats and the Republicans. The Democrats seem to be really after Russia. The Republicans seem to be really after China. How do you view this new relationship of power in the world today?
Well, what I did not sufficiently appreciate in 2003 was that empires were not quite finished. I said this is no longer the era of imperialism because neither the United States nor any other power could invade another country, successfully run it, unlike the 19th century empires. But of course, what Russia and China have both revealed is an increasing revisionist imperialism. That is, what they are seeking to do is to restore the greater power that the Tsarist regimes in Russia and the imperial system of China, and that is the key to their expansionism. They are not going back beyond the bounds of former empires, but they are aggressing, and in the case of Russia, pursuing full-scale war. But of course, Ukraine was a part of Russia for a long time. In the East, had a substantial number, a majority probably in some regions, of Russian speakers. So historically, it was a mixed situation. That doesn't in any sense give any justification to Putin's war. But it does put it in historical context. And of course, Putin has referred to himself as a new Peter the Great, who was the Russian Tsar who greatly expanded Russian territory. China similarly aims at the kind of dominance that it had in Asia during the Qin Dynasty. In the 18th century, so that it seeks Taiwan, it seeks firm control over the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, and it seeks firm control of Tibet, and dominance in the South China Sea, which again it had during imperial times. Now these are all outrageous moves in a period in which the world thought it had gone towards a period of relative peace and stability of boundaries, but it is a new reality.
But what about the role of the United States, though? I mean, we definitely see those positions of power of Russia and China through the ideological networks and the interpretation of not only our leadership here in their own interests, but also a mainstream media, which seems to relentlessly echo and parrot the views of those who hold ideological dominance over the narrative in the United States.
Yes. The United States hasn't had a very successful record, a successful history of imperialism in the post-war period, post-1945 period. It's not really won any significant wars. It's drawn Korea, to lost Vietnam, and the various interventions in more recent years have been striking failures. And indeed, both political parties have shown some reluctance now to get involved or to get American troops involved. And of course, both Obama and Trump contributed to the collapse of American power in Afghanistan. And the US is now confining itself only to supporting local allies. So in a way, there has been a reduction in American imperialism. And there is a sense across much of the world that the US is actually somewhat in decline, and as it can no longer claim to be the global power.
How do you reconcile that with a military budget for defense of this country that reached nearly $1 trillion last year? If the US is not projecting power internationally as an imperialist country, and of course we know that there's the CIA, which still destabilizes governments which it does not see fall in line with U.S. power or U.S. foreign policy objectives. And again, how do we reconcile that if the U.S. is not projecting imperial might around the world, this $1 trillion defense budget, when, of course, we have so many problems here at home that could be addressed with that money?
Yes, well, but I've never claimed that human societies are rational or its leaders are rational. In fact, last year I published a book on wars in which I said that almost all wars are deeply irrational. They don't achieve their goals, and they incur great suffering. So what is the point of that massive American military? Well, it's a product of the past, and the past changes slowly. And of course, the oddity is that Trump will probably increase it. But what's it doing? Not very much. It's disastrous for the reason that you give, which is that the money should go elsewhere to much more socially progressive causes. But in terms of the world, at the moment, the U.S. doesn't, U.S. military doesn't do very much harm in the world. Of course, there are, as you say, always the CIA type interventions, and they don't change. And in the case of Israel, the American military offers it a chance to engage in what has become essentially a genocidal project. But the fact that there are American bases all over the world is not there for a great purpose.
Right. You mentioned Israel, and it's not just Israel, but also, you know, the U.S. military, the Pentagon, I think of the Southern Command out of in Central America, that there are these regional alliances that they have, and largely they have this what's called the IMET, which is the sort of military training and supplying of weaponry with militaries around the world. That's something, right? I mean, that's where a good portion of perhaps that defense budget goes as well, which is the U.S. doesn't have to be on the front line if it can fund proxies, right?
Yes, but it hasn't been all that successful in that respect. But yes, I mean, I think one should be grateful for small mercies. The small mercy being that this massive military is not being used directly. However, the expansionism of China and Russia do raise the possibility of something far worse, of a more direct use of American power. And though I think that American policy, with or without Trump, will also will inevitably lead to the forsaking of Ukraine and the legitimization of Russian control over the east of Ukraine, that is, well, it's better than the U.S. getting involved in a war with Russia.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because it always seemed to me like, you know, I grew up during the Cold War, You certainly experienced it as an adult, and there always seemed to be this concept of spheres of influence that, you know, this part of the region and the world, this is our sphere of influence, this is your sphere of influence. And there was this sort of unspoken understanding that, you know, we wouldn't meddle in your sphere if you didn't meddle in ours. And it seems as if that sort of detente has broken down in the sort of world order that we're facing today. Nobody seems to be respecting those sort of unspoken rules that were established during the Cold War.
Yes, that's entirely true. The rhetoric of the United States and of the Soviet Union mainly stayed at that level, at the rhetorical level of hostility, except that they both engaged in covert and semi-covert activities around the world. But yes, that was, in a way, good news, but the bad news was it's constantly involved wars in other countries that were not part of the agreed division of the world, like Vietnam. It was not an ideal situation, but something that I find extremely depressing is that all the old geopolitical rhetoric has come back again. And the notion that America has to resist Chinese encroachments, and it's not so clear about Russia, partly because of the existence of NATO and of the Europeans, but kind of war between China and the United States could result from posturing and provocative kinds of actions, and that would be an utter disaster for the world. But as I analyze the causes of World War One, that was a disaster for the world. None of the participants actually wanted to go to war, but they trapped themselves into that by their kind of geopolitical stances and the incoherence of their policy making. And that people should think about outbreak of World War One when they think about the potential for war between the United States, China, and Russia.
And let me remind our listeners, that's the voice of my guest today, Michael Mann, a historian, sociologist, the author of the 4-volume series, Sources of Social Power, also the author of another book called Incoherent Empire. I want to turn to yet another one of your books, The Dark Side of Democracy. And I'm wondering if we can't look at the situation between Israel and Palestinians and the way in which slaughter is being justified today through the lens that you provided in your book, The Dark Side of Democracy.
Yes, I think just a word, first of all, that we've talked about empires, a part of some empires, but not of the ones we've been talking about, really, is settler colonialism. And of course, Israel is the main case in the world at present of settler colonialism. It's that is the kind of provocation, the main provocation of the troubles there. I also think that just as when I wrote Incoherent Empire, I'm stressing the ignorance of American policymakers, I do that again about the Middle East, because what's happened without anybody realizing it is that the U.S. is participating in an intra-Islamic civil war between Sunnis and Shias. The Shia are the minority globally, but the majority in Iran, and have substantial contributions, population contributions in the Lebanon, in the Yemen. And the U.S., in talking about Iran and its its evil allies, seems to ignore the fact that they represent the Shia version of Islam, whereas American allies like Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, they represent the majority Sunni. And we're involved in a civil war on the side of the Sunni against the Shia. And that is utterly irrational. There's no good reason why that should be so. Iran is not a very desirable state, but nor is Saudi Arabia. And I fear that that virtually no one in the U.S. refers to that. Not even leftist journalists seems to go unnoticed. There's no good reason for us to be involved in those struggles, to regard Shia movements, rebellious movements, as terrorists, and to offer substantial weaponry to the main Sunni powers. And I think that's an area of the world in which US policy is disastrous and foolish. Better to make friends with your enemies.
What about Palestine and Israel? It does seem as if when I see Israelis on social media celebrating bombings, celebrating death, and really we hear them almost drawing out a ethnic distinction between those who are self-identified as Israeli versus those who are Palestinian, despite the racial similarities. Do you see this as almost taking on the dimensions of an ethnic cleansing of sorts, given this let's talk about that.
Oh, yes, for sure. In fact, I think, in my book, The Dark Side of Democracy, I have various different stages of ethnic cleansing, getting worse and worse as you go up the scale. And I think that is leaving the area of murderous ethnic cleansing into the sphere of genocide. Genocide's a process, so you can't say it's at one point in time it's there, but the Israeli process is clearly towards the elimination of the Palestinian community. Like Hitler initially, Hitler wanted all the Jews to leave, and when they didn't, that's when he became more savage, and which ended in the Holocaust, of course. Well, the behavior of the Israeli military, and with very substantial approval from within Israeli Jews themselves, that has become genocidal.
Dr. Mann, before I ask you my final question, I want to talk a little bit about your new book, On Wars. Can you tell us what's that about?
Well, it's about wars throughout history and throughout across the world. So it's about all major civilizations which are well enough recorded to be able to make generalizations about them. And I analyze how wars happen, why they happen. And if there is a single conclusion of the book, it is that wars are usually irrational. Obviously, it takes two to make a war, and if one wins, they might seem to get some benefit, but they rarely do. And those who are defeated clearly don't benefit. But very often, there is no winner, and just a lot of devastation. I analyze carefully America's wars from the Civil War onward, note the decision-making process, which is usually fairly incoherent and which rarely produces results. I mean, the World War II is a kind of exception in some ways. It's clearly an ideological war, provoked straightforwardly by Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. But most wars are not like that. They emerge out of confused interactions, negotiations, the pressure of interest groups, and the previous record of wars. And countries, states, differ greatly in terms of their degree of their militarism. I use the expression of militarism being baked in to their culture and institutions, as was obviously the case in the Roman Republic, for example, which is one of my cases, or in the United States round about the year 2000, in which war is seen as a kind of natural solution to international problems. But it's really, the book is a monument to human irrationality. As Benjamin Franklin said, there never was a just war or a bad peace. I think that's the main argument.
I want to ask you one final question. As we all eventually are, you're coming, you're in your twilight years, as they say. as I feel my own mortality as I ask this question, you have seen such a sweep of history and have written an extraordinary rendition of how power evolves in societies from hunter-gatherer societies all the way through the Cold War, just an amazing venture that you undertook, an adventure, I'm sure, in writing it. What advice do you have how we should be entering this new period of U.S. history, U.S. role in the world, as we analyze the power within societies and how it is projected into the world? How would you suggest, what do you suggest we should be looking for, watching, keeping in our minds as this new period of history unfolds?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. Yes, we are entering into a new phase, greatly complicated by the fact that the incoming president has pretty incoherent ideas about the world. I think that this is the time to it's the time, especially for Democrats, to think about what they stand for in the world, to accept that the U.S. is not the only democratic power, it's not the only freedom-loving people, all that kind of rhetoric that cant of American politicians, that should be abandoned, and one should look at national liberation movements as potentially things that we might support rather than define as terrorists. And I think all of this needs study, and the complexity needs to be appreciated. So not simply things like the military-industrial complex or global capitalism, but all of these, the power ultimately is about the intermeshing of economic, ideological, military, and political power, and that we should take all of them into account in our analyses.
All right.
That's the best I can do.
Well, I think you did very well. I can't tell you again what an honor and a privilege it is to have spent some time with you in discussion today. Again, that's the voice of our guest, Michael Mann, a very well-renowned historian, sociologist, wrote the four-volume series, The Sources of Social Power, as well as Incoherent Empire and another book, The Dark Side of Democracy, which we discussed today. Dr. Mann, thank you so very much for joining us today and sharing this with our listeners here on Flashpoints.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein.
Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Tune into KBO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported KBOO during our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign.